Okay. And what year were you and Ginny officially divorced?
Oh dear, that would have been in, I think, 61, I believe.
Okay.
Gee, I should remember that. Probably another kind of thing you don't like to remember, so
No.
you don't.
One of the people that Ginny has mentioned quite a bit for Camp Denali was Johnny Boucher. I was wondering
Yeah.
if you could talk about him a little bit.
He was a fellow, he was the last resident of Kantishna, year-round resident. He lived in a little cabin across Moose Creek. You had to get to his cabin by pulling yourself across Moose Creek on a little tramway. And he pretty much lived on his homebrew beer, which he kept stored in his dugout little cellar under his cabin. He was a character. He had never been part of the modern world. He didn't want to go outside. He didn't want to go to town. He didn't feel he could survive there. He was a great storyteller, if you could understand him. He did have quite a strong accent. He called himself a bohunk. Well, a bohunk, I believe, was what the miners were called, mostly from Yugoslavia and Eastern Europe. Possibly Bulgaria too, and Romania maybe, but in the old Yugoslavia. But he was a friendly guy. He loved company. We used to go over and visit him and spend time with him when we could take time from the work and off season, before and early and late in the season, we could go over. In fact, that's how we met Gary Kenwood, who became a very important person in our life. And I don't know if people have told you about Gary Kenwood or not, but he was a guy who had just gotten out of the Korean War in the Marines, and he was a wonderful guy, a fellow from Three Rivers, California, down there in the at the foot of the mountains under the giant forest, the Sequoia Park. Grown up on a ranch, but he was very young age. He was leading fire crews and trail crews in the mountains and taking pack horses and a rancher. But one day he decided he had a friend who said, "Let's go up to Alaska." Okay, and they made an agreement. They'd go up. Well, of course, his friend, I say, of course, it does happen frequently anyway, his friend backed out at the last minute. Didn't bother Gary. He had an old Jeep pickup truck. He said, "I'm going up anyway." So he drove that truck up to Alaska, and I guess he drove out the park highway, and he realized there was a cabin over there across the river. I guess he pulled himself across the river, and he was talking with Johnny Busia, and Celia happened to be flying down from Fairbanks right at that time with a load of stuff in her little white Piper airplane, landed at Kantishna, either walked up, or I don't know how, maybe they had a car down there, from the airstrip up, stopped at Johnny Boucicea's cabin, and here was Gary Kenwood. And she says, "Well, you want to come up and help us build camp or do something?" "Okay, might as well." Gary had a foghorn voice, and he was an absolutely amazing character. You could make a whole story about just Gary Kenwood stories. But anyway, he ended up, of course, staying all summer and building a number of buildings there. He built a garage, first a garage for the storage of all the car parts and gasoline and things. He was a naturalist. He knew a lot about nature that he had just taught himself. He had worked for the California Fish and Game Department in his younger years before getting into the Korean War. He would bulldoze these deer that they wanted to tag with, or they'd give them shots, and they would put a thing in their ear. The wildlife students would get Gary to work with them, and they would corner one of these deer, and Gary would, he knew just how to handle that animal and get him down to where he could hold him where he couldn't kick him or butt him, and they would tie his feet, and they'd get whatever information they wanted, or weigh him or something, and then let him go. He was doing that when he was just a young guy.
Wow.
Amazing fellow. Great, big, tall guy. And he knew a lot about wildlife. He loved, well, he learned about photography at Camp Denali, I believe, because we had a lot of photographers up there all the time. Some of these people, the Through the Lens tours, you'd come up and from Los Angeles, and what was his name? The brother of the guy that does all those beautiful pictures for Arizona highways, Emil Munch, his name was.
Oh.
He would bring these tours up, and they'd have beautiful cameras, and Gary was just fascinated. He'd ask people. He learned all about these cameras and got to be a good photographer. And he eventually ended up taking wildlife movies and got very good at it because he was an animal handler. He had a natural, almost an uncanny ability to handle animals. And he eventually was working for the game farm out at Squim, Washington, who had a lot of animals that they used for movies. And he ended up with the wolves that they used in Never Cry Wolf, that movie that he made, and he helped him make. And Big Ben, this great big grizzly bear, who was as gentle as a lamb, but he was an enormous animal. And Gary worked with that bear all the time. And he told me once, he said, you know, Woody, if that bear were in this room, he would be able to reach his paw up on his hind legs, and he'd be able to reach that balcony. On that railing, on that balcony. I'm like, this is a big animal.
It's like 20 feet.
It's enormous. And he ended up, well, he did a lot of movies with these animals. Then he brought up some geese from the very time they cracked out of the egg. And the geese bonded with him. He'd be in a wetsuit right down in the water. And he made a movie, Flying... what was the name of that? It was a black and white, beautiful movie. Wild Goose Calling, was it? I forget the name of it, but in which he used these trained geese that he had. And it's quite a story. Working with a photographer, they worked down at Joshua Tree National Monument a lot and made some interesting movies.
So he worked for camp for a couple years?
He did. And he came back. Did he stay? He stayed in Alaska that winter. Now, would that have been, let's see, 1 year he organized some other climbers together, and Howie Kantner, Seth's dad, was one of them, and Dix was one, and Keith Jones, Anora's husband, who now live down in Three Rivers in a ranch that Gary found for them, and who else was it? Well, Anora Bucknell. It was then. She wasn't married then. But Keith Jones and a couple of others, I can't remember their names, made a trip, the last trip, to climb Mount McKinley, which went in from the east. And they skied out and climbed out, or hiked out from park headquarters 100 miles to the Muldrow Glacier. And they climbed that mountain. And it was done in the old-fashioned hard way. And I think Gary Kenwood, well, they'll all admit that Gary Kenwood was the reason why they made it.
And that was in the early 70s?
That was 1960. I think it was 61.
Was that
the date
early?
Wrong. Yes.
Oh.
It was 60 or 61, and I can't remember for sure.
Well, that's close enough.
Which the, there's a picture on our wall of the caribou migration, which Gary took out there, big black and white. He did beautiful photography. And those guys will never forget that trip. In fact, they had a reunion back in Hawaii, what was it, the 40th year reunion or something like that. They all got together back at the Candace Ranch. But anyway, that was just a little bit of Gary Kenwood.
Well, another
dear friend.
Another thing that has come up, Ginny has mentioned at some point in one, I don't know if it was one winter or multiple winters, you did things like led ski trips or something at McKinley Park Hotel, where there were military
No, what was, I didn't tell me? Do that. What she was referring to, I suspect, was a trip which Bill Nancarrow and I made with the Park Service had these two things called weasels, which were a military vehicle that had been developed during World War II. It was a full track vehicle with skis on the front.
Right.
It was the predecessor of a snowmobile. And these tracks were on a rubber band, and they would always be throwing their tracks. Well, somebody had taken one of these snowmobiles out to the Thurifera River Bar, about almost 70 miles out the road. I don't remember even what the reason for that was, a patrol or whether they were checking on some trapping or something, but it threw a track, of course, so it was helpless. Couldn't do anything about it. Well, they wanted to get that, what did we do? Did we take another?
I
think Bill Nancarrow and I took another track out for that vehicle with a dog sled. And we hitched up my job at that time was, one of my jobs was taking care of the dog team mm-hmm. at McKinley Park, which they had inherited from the old days when they used to use the team all the time for patrolling in the park. And I'd cook up their supper in this great big cauldron of things, and I'd run them. And Bill Nancarrow and I'm pretty sure that's right, we took this track out, which was a different one, and we hauled this thing on the big dog sled out over all the passes in the old dog team trail, which does not necessarily follow the road, but it's down in the valleys. And we got that thing out there. And Ginny and I had worked out a plan where if we ran out of dog food, which we did, and we got a little low on dog food, we knew what we would do. So we're out there. Now, this is a mixture of the old ways and the new ways. And Ginny comes flying over with the Cessna. We had the Cessna 170 in those then. And I was standing on top of the dog sled waving a dog salmon in my hand. That meant we run out of dogfish and bring some more, drop it to us. And she wiggled the wings, and they'd turn around and go back, and she'd pick up some more dogfish from the... These were fish that we'd gotten from the Indians, right, that they'd dry them and hack them, you know, and put them over the line and dry them. Great for using for food on the dog when you're on the trail. And sure enough, a few hours later, she'd come out and drop this bale of dogfish to us. And we got that thing out there, and I can't remember what the eventual fate of that snowmobile was. But anyway, Bill and I had a wonderful trip out of it, where we stayed in the Copper Mountain Patrol Cabin, which was just a wreck by that time. The floods had ruined it completely, but the other patrol cabins were fine. We used those. I think that may have been the trip that Ginny was referring to.
Yeah, but she's also talked about at the McKinley Hotel, the military ran programs in the winter.
Yeah, that's true.
And I had folk dancing, and they had this little ski hill.
Oh, yeah, I'd forgotten about that. Isn't that interesting? She remembered that. And I think I may have used that dog team for demonstrations and taking people on rides. Mm. Actually, we did do that. I'd forgotten all about that.
But was that the time when you were still working for the park?
Yeah, that's right. That was.
So you were living down there.
Yeah, that was in the early years, in the 50s. It was great working with those dogs. I guess I got a love of dogs from that I've always had. And we used to have our own, little team and mini team and when we lived in Dog Patch.
Now, did you run your team from Dog Patch to the university?
I sure did. I remember that. We had, do we have five dogs? I think or four. Una was the leader. Celia's dog was a great leader, smart dog. And I had fixed up little burlap bags of shavings or chips from the shop, and I had those out under cottonwood trees and back of the university there, which was all, it's all buildings now, of course, right. But those were trees. And I had little places where the dogs could lie during the day when I was going to school. And so I'd go out there in the morning, and then the dogs would rest there. And then by the time it came time to go home, it'd be dark, of course, and wow, were there those dogs ever raring to go. And you'd hitch them up, and you'd keep that sled very well tied to a good stout tree with about 20-foot length of good stout rope with a knot on the end. And you get the team all hitched up, and they'd be just waiting. And then finally you pull the knot out on the loop on that and release the thing and just ride on those runners and get your head down as fast as you could, good and low, because they're tearing down this trail, the lickety-split. And the willow branches, of course, if it did snow, these willow branches would be right down and hit you in the face. Well, that would last about 200 yards, and then the dogs would get their big spurt, and that would be over. And they'd settle down to a nice little run, a little trot, and you'd go sliding out, and all the noise you'd hear was the hiss of the runners on the sled. It was beautiful. Wonderful way to go to school.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that. And I guess I could see the charm that people like Susan Butcher, that loved their, she was an amazing woman, and she just loved those dogs so much. She had something like 100 dogs, yeah. I think, that she and her husband out there. Yeah, I can see the fascination that she had with it, although the racing, she was a powerful competitor. She had a competitive drive that wouldn't quit, and that's what made her a good dog racer. And it's interesting to follow the careers of some of these people. In fact, I sent Ginny recently a cutout of an aviation a magazine from Alaska Airlines, which had a story about a number of these mushers. Jeff King was one of them, and a little box in there telling about Susan Butcher. This is after she died.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a beautiful story. And I knew that Ginny knew some of these people. And I don't know how many, because it's after I left Alaska.
Right.
But I, of course, read about Reddington and these people. And Susan Butcher came down one time. They have a thing at Lakeside School. That's kind of a digression. But at Lakeside, they have a program called the BBA Foundation. A kid, a Lakeside kid that was killed in a climbing accident a number of years ago, and his family left an endowment, and they, with that endowment, they pay people, interesting speakers, to come once a year to Lakeside, and they give lectures, and Susan Butcher was the person one year. And I guess Bernie Ngo, the head of Lakeside School, had somehow contacted her. He knew about her, but she came, and I went and saw that program, her slide program, telling about it. It was just wonderful. And then they get a little get together later at the McKay Chapel, and I told her I'm Woody, Romney's dad, and do you remember Romney? And she said, oh my gosh, yeah, she remembered Romney. And in fact, she had named her daughter after Romney's middle name, Tekla, which came from the Teklanika River, actually. And I think she had one daughter who's named that.
Yes, she does.
I'd like to meet her some year. You know her.
No, I don't know her. I just know who they are, you know, Fairbanks, small town. And it's Tekla. There's another daughter, but I don't remember her name.
Yeah, I don't remember her name either. Yeah.
I want to say Tekla's maybe 12 or 14, something like that.
Something about in that area.
Now, were you as avid a skier as Ginny and Celia?
Oh, yeah. We all love to ski. And We liked cross-country skiing. Ginny's kept up her cross-country skiing. She's just very good and stays in good shape because of that.
Now,
she didn't have much snow last winter, I guess.
Did you grow up cross-country skiing, or how did you
No, I didn't. When I was a kid in Maine, we had these boards with a strap over them, and that was the extent of what we knew about skiing. But some friends back in Newton, Massachusetts, that actually family of skiers, that one of their older son was dating my sister, Teddy, Jimmy Klein, and he was a skier and he loved skiing up in New Hampshire in the mountains. And they said, Woody, we got to get you interested in skiing. So we got started a little bit. And then just then World War II came along. And I started at the University of Maine. My first college experience after graduating from Newton High School, I went to the University of Maine in Orono. At that time it was up near Bangor. And okay, that's when they started drafting 18-year-olds, right that fall. And so you had a choice. You want to volunteer for whatever service you want, you can get it. Wait and be drafted, and you go wherever the hell they want you to go. So I said, well, from the Kleins and everything, I'd gotten pretty enthusiastic about skiing. Sounded like fun. And hadn't been skiing very much, really. Okay, join the 10th Mountain Division. You get your letter of recommendation, blah, blah, blah. Go out to Camp Hale. This was in February of 1943. The war was already been going a bit, but I got inducted from Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and out to Camp Hale. Well, Camp Hale is at 9,200 feet elevation, and you get off this train, you come right up from sea level, and you put this barracks bag on your shoulder, and you start walking down this road towards where you're supposed to go, and all of a sudden you're feeling kind of funny, and so you set the barracks bag down and sit on it for a while and realize that you're about ready to pass out, and it happened to a number of people. You finally you get over it and you're able to go on, but there's a sudden altitude change and you aren't really quite, you just aren't acclimated to it
yet. Where is Camp Hale?
It's on Tennessee, it's near Tennessee Pass in Colorado, and it's on the railroad line, right on the Arkansas River that goes up to Tennessee Pass at the highest point where the Denver and Rio Grande Western Railroad crosses the Continental Divide. It's right up on the Continental Divide in Colorado, and not far from Leadville. Leadville is really the nearest town of any size, which had been a mining town in the 19th century.
Right.
They had taken a lot of money out of Leadville. But that's where the Army had built this camp to train people because they realized they didn't have anybody that knew how to fight in the mountains. Well, the Germans sure as heck did. And so that's what our job was. And so I was there for two different, was it, seasons, summers and winters, I believe. Basic training just seemed to continue, and we'd do these maneuvers up in the mountains, which were more strenuous almost than what we went through in actual combat in Italy, except in a different way.
Yeah.
But, okay, the winter, I guess, of 43-44, when they had what they called the D-Series, which was when we were all out of camp, nobody was in Camp Hale, we're all up in tactical situation, carrying tents, skis, and sleeping bags, and whatever we had to carry, our own rations, in the high mountains above camp, up around 10,000 feet, and just sleeping in our sleeping bags on a bow bed or whatever you could to try to keep warm. You couldn't have fires because it was supposed to be what they call tactical. In other words, if you had fire, the enemy would see where you are and shoot you. Well, right about then, I heard that my dad had died. So I got out and I skied out and got back to the railroad and took the train back to Massachusetts for a little furlough. Then came back after that week or two, I guess it was, I had. Camp it was still empty. They were all still out, and probably was a week, up in the mountains. And so I had to find my outfit wherever they were. Somehow I found out where they were and got up there with the rest of my company. And now there again, I was coming right from sea level up to a high altitude. And I guess I started feeling sick. And the guy said, you better get on back to camp to the hospital. They do still have the hospital open because I guess they thought I had pneumonia. And somehow, and I don't know how I ever did that, I managed to ski on back I think we were on skis, not snowshoes then, I don't remember, but I got back to the hospital, and I had an enormous high temperature. The nurse thought I'd put the thermometer on a radiator. You had steam radiators then. But I hadn't, and boy, I was one sick cookie for a while. That's when I met that Ned Fancher, the guy I right. mentioned, who told me about a funny little university in Fairbanks.
Right.
Happened to be in the hospital. Well, I recovered from that and then got back to the training, but they didn't know what to do with the 10th Mountain Division with the trouble. Originally, we were supposed to go back and liberate Norway. Well, that didn't happen. So here it comes, the last year of the war. Finally, they said, well, we got to use these guys, so let's send them to Italy. So they did. We ended up in sailing over to Naples with a troop ship, and then on up to Livorno, northern, farther up the coast, and then into the Apennines, where during the last winter of the war, that was 44, Christmas of 44, we ended over there. The German army was pretty much on the run, but those guys holed up in the Alps didn't feel that way at all. And the Apennines, we were in the Apennines, okay, that was pretty minor. There was a little bit of patrol action during that winter, but nothing much. Okay, spring comes, April. President Roosevelt dies. They're having this big, what they call the big push. The thing is, all the troops in this Fifth Army and these outfits, and there's the 10th Mountain Division along with some people from the other divisions, 92nd. We were to push down out of the Apennines across the Po Valley, which is a great wide valley of northern Italy. It's the breadbasket of Italy. Mm-hmm. The Germans had that. They had all the bridges. They had complete control over that area. We had to push down into that, drive the Germans across the Po Valley and up into the Alps. Well, that was quite a proposition, and there's a lot been written about that.
Right.
And I remember that very, very vividly. It was a terrible time because we were advancing mules, 2.5-ton trucks, military vehicles, ammunition carriers, and everybody out there on the roads. The Germans, some of them units trying to surrender, they'd be in the farmhouses. Old guys and young kids that were then in the German army at that time come out with their hands in back of their heads. Mostly just wanted to be through with it. Everybody was so sick of the war. And we're all mixed up on that road. And all of a sudden, I remember seeing P-38s, which were these double fuselage American fighter planes coming down, and they'd be strafing us. They'd be firing, you'd see their guns firing at the column on the road, and because they couldn't tell whether we were Germans or Americans. Somebody'd shout, hey, somebody throw a yellow smoke grenade out. These are American planes, and they think we're Germans. And they would do that, and as soon as they see that yellow smoke grenade, these planes would fly right over our heads. You could look through you could see their pilot in the cockpit, and they'd suddenly pull up. And they'd realize, geez, these are Americans. But it was a terrifying experience, though.
Sounds horrible.
And you'd try to duck into a jeep or into a ditch, or you'd try to get behind a truck or something for some sort of cover. But we were sitting ducks. Well, anyway, that's a whole other story.
That sounds horrible.
We got them up into the Alps and then up to Lago di Garda, and that's another whole story about the battle along the side of Lago di Garda, which is a very long, narrow lake in southern Italy. The north end of it is sheer rock walls, especially on the west side, east side too, pretty much. Riva del Garda is a little resort town at the north end of it. The south end of the lake, it's kind of like Lake Chelan in a way, only much more rugged. South end, flat. North end, very narrow, mountainous cavern, and the Germans had blasted the tunnels. It was just one tunnel after another that had been cut through the mountain for this road on the east side, a similar one on the west side. And it was a gorgeous lake, just beautiful. But as the Germans, well, you don't want to go into with all this detail because that's kind of outside. Anyway, the Germans would blast these tunnels shut as they retreated north. So we had to get in these amphibious vehicles called ducks, which is a great big 2.5-ton truck, but it's also on a boat hull. Mm-hmm. And they'd go around the tunnel and then have to land. And meantime, the Germans way up in these mountains firing down at us. That was, talk about sitting ducks. Yeah. That was an awful. But anyway, we finally, I was lucky. A lot of guys died on that. On that road, but Martha and I went back there years later on bicycles, and I remember finding that tunnel and where I lost my hearing, much of it, because
oh, really?
A guy fired a tank destroyer on the road right above where I was, down in the rocks below it, and that muzzle blast, I think, raised hell with my hearing.
Yeah.
But anyway, I lived through it, and that's all you cared about in those times. I was lucky.
Yeah, it sounds horrible.
Yeah, it was. That's, I guess, what I had a lot of problem working through some of that, what they call it, they have a name for it now, stress syndrome or something.
Yeah, post-traumatic stress
syndrome. Yeah, that's right. And God help these poor soldiers that are dealing with depleted uranium and things like that in today's weapons.
Yeah.
We haven't learned anything.
No. And one question I forgot to ask you, which is what year you were born.
I was born in 1924, January 12th, 24, the year that Lenin died. Would you believe that? How about that? One year I always remember date. My dad was born in 1869, and that is only 5 years after the end of the Civil War.
Wow.
Do you realize what a different era he was in?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, I've taken up a good part of your day. It's been a
pleasure.
It's been
fascinating. I hope we can do something with all that stuff.
I hope so, too.
Will be worth something to you.
Well, it is. And even you talking about your experiences in the war is, you know, part of this is about you and who you are. And, you know, those are experiences that other people don't know about.
That's true. Because living through a combat situation like that in a war changes you fundamentally in certain ways, and namely for one thing in your attitude towards death,
mm-hmm.
which is, and also in your attitude towards what you can do. You've been in the military put us in extremes where you'd swear, I cannot take another step, I'm dead, I'm finished, and you get up and you take another step and you take another step. And you find you can do it. There's a thing called sisu. The Finns have two words, sauna and sisu. And the only way they can translate sisu is the ability to go on when you can't go on any longer. And the Finns, of all people in the world, know about that. And you learn about that in the military. Maybe that's a lesson that, if there's anything good coming ever from military, maybe there's something to that.
Yeah. Just to wrap it up, my last thought and question for you is what your experience in Alaska and having people like Ginny in your life have meant to you.
Oh, wow. What a question. Well, it really has been the theme, a central theme of my life, to which I relate almost all my other experiences, I guess. I guess I could say that about the years in Alaska, and maybe somewhat, in a way, some of the experiences during World War II have a profound effect on you. And they give you, I think those years in Alaska give me a feeling of self-confidence that I know I could do lots of things. I could figure out how to do something, which I didn't know how. I didn't know I could do stuff before. I didn't know how to use a chainsaw or any of that stuff before going up there. You just learn because you have to. And building log cabins, building houses and stuff, I never technically learned how to do that properly, which is part of the problem with many of the buildings I've built. But that's another story. You can ask Carl Rosenberg about that. He's been struggling with with the remains of those buildings for years. But anyway, that's another subject. But I think it's given me a lot of confidence in my own ability. It's given me a feeling of self-worth, which I did not have before. I had never been brought up in an environment that, as good as it was in many ways, that made me feel, that taught me to be independent and a doer. It was more a follower, a very autocratic dad. Okay, you go from that to the military, where all you do is, by God, you do what you're told, right, is obey orders. That doesn't help any. And that may lead to some other conclusions, too, about my later life. Mm-hmm. But I think being able to build camp and do that stuff and build the cabins up north and build the cabin over in the Mettau Valley that we did later, all of that gave me a feeling of self-worth and confidence, which is very, very central and very important to me. And also, another thing it taught me that I love to teach. I'm exact opposite of my dad. I'm a natural-born teacher. I love to work with kids and teach them stuff. And I don't know, maybe some of that I learned up there. Mm-hmm. You maybe learn things about yourself from experiences like that you never knew, you didn't realize you had, or things you didn't know you were capable of. Mm-hmm. That's what a frontier experience is. It is challenging.
Okay. And maybe, now,
go ahead.
I was going to say, anything else that you wanted to talk about that I haven't asked or we haven't talked about?
I don't think so, except I want to stress again how extremely fortunate I feel I have been to have lived in those times and in those circumstances when one person could make a difference in a physical, natural world like that. Other people, somebody like Bill Gates, did a pioneering thing with his computers. Mm-hmm. And they explored a whole new world of a technological, of a nature. But I'm sure that he and Paul Allen and those kids that we knew at Lakeside were, they have a bet, I'll bet all of them have a same feeling of a little bit of that same thing I did, of having kind of pushed something forward. And they did amazing stuff. And in a totally different realm as far as pushing on a new frontier, maybe.
Right. And that's why I describe Camp Denali as the first ecotourism place. And now everything, that's the buzzword.
Yes,
but at the time,
yes, exactly.
Nobody was doing
exactly.
That. Exactly.
But
guys
did. We did a lot of good naturalist-type training, more than the park even did, by having time with these people. You had time. And you didn't have a lot of distractions. You didn't have a bar. And you didn't have... You sat around and talked, and you played music, and the kids would sing, and we'd have campfires and things. And that was really neat. It was a closeness that people had, mm-hmm. which was really precious.
Yeah.
Those are precious experiences for me.
Yeah. I know one thing I was going to say. Ginny has said you were a very good folk dancer.
Oh, I love to dance, and she was a good dancer, too. And and we still now dancing. We've had to give up skiing with age, but... dancing, we have still done somewhat, but mostly now we play music for the folk dancers.
Mm-hmm.
So now music is sort of replacing the dancing, which, and I'm not, well, I'll be able to dance again a little, I think, but not the way we used to.
No.
But Now we have a band that we play every other Saturday for the folk dancers out here. Great. For international. I play in a Scandinavian group. Martha plays for a different Scandinavian dance group. She plays fiddle. I play hammered dulcimer. And then we also play in a Balkan music. Balkan music is very different from Scandinavian, but we love both of them.
Right.
And so we both play in that little group, and it's a wonderfully rewarding. In fact, just last year, at this late age, I started to learn to play the recorder, and that meant learning to read music, which I have never done. I've never been able to make sense out of those hen scratches and fly specks that Pete Seeger talks about. But by golly, I'm learning it. And it's only frustrating to me that Martha already knows that, so it's so easy for her. She doesn't want to practice it. She's not a practicer. I tend to be a plodder. And I just sit there and work at these darn things. All she's got to learn is which holes to plug on the recorder. She can read the stuff perfectly, the timing, everything. It's all Greek to me, or was, but now I'm making sense out. So we play with a little recorder group.
Great.
And I'm enjoying that tremendously. It's a challenge. It's like learning a new language.
Yep.
Except more fun.
Well, Martha is now home, and she's probably thinking, gosh, they're still talking. My God.
Well, no.
She can't think of something else to go do.
It's a wonder you haven't run out of what, you don't have tape, but
no, I don't
you
know.
Don't we're, run out of that.
We're going to see. It's an experiment, so I'll turn it off. So thank you.